Class, this is Dr. Lydia Black. You already know about her. You've seen her around the school this week. We invited her out for the 160th anniversary of the school because of her great knowledge of the Aleutians and early Russian period of the Aleutians and just the wealth of information. She's a cultural anthropologist?
Social
anthropologist, all right. And she's done a lot of translating from original Russian documents and books into English. This is the most recent one, The Notes on the Islands of the Analashka Dish. Some of you have looked at this. She's also translated two volumes about the same size of the journals of an Aleut priest at Atka and up on the Yukon, the journals of Nizvetsov, and just a whole host of interesting articles. During the time that she's been out here, when did you first come? 75?
75.
She's done a... Yeah. Sure. Come right in. Let's see. We might need one... No, we've got enough chairs.
Yeah, I just had four.
Yeah, we've got plenty of chairs. Sure. Since she started coming out here in 75, she's done a lot of local kinds of historical discoveries, I guess. She discovered that in the church here, there are icons painted by an Aleut artist that knowledge had been lost for a long time. She's also done a lot of research into the origins of the written Aleut language and the role that a chief from over in the Akun-Akutan area played in that. And she's written about that. A lot of things. This week she's translated an 1807 listing of people here at Analashka who came to participate in church activities with a visiting priest. And that was an exciting bit of information. I'm sort of stalling for the other four people to arrive.
Stalling.
then we'll start. Dr. Black has been a professor back in Rhode Island at Providence College. And when last year you were invited to the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and she's there again this year. And
they asked me to stay on.
Yeah, which is going to be awfully
nice.
Yeah, it's going to be very good. Okay. The three people who just come in, this is Dr. Lydia Black. You may have seen her around the school. And I suggested that you might want to talk to us about the early period of Alaska history, the arrival of the Russians, or the conditions here prior to whatever you want.
Now,
to.
You want to talk about the early period of the written history. As an anthropologist, he does not begin with the books written on history or with the first written document. I firmly believe that all the people have a history that goes to the Garden of Eden and Adam of Eve. If you think particular groups of people, they always say, we have been here forever, and barring unforeseen circumstances, they believe we're going to go on being here forever. It doesn't matter that it isn't necessarily true. What matters is that the people believe that this is true. It doesn't matter what is written in weighty tomes by various academics for you. When you structure your life and you decide what is right, what is wrong, it isn't what is says, this is a fact and this is the way you should believe. It matters what you really believe in what you do. So as an anthropologist, to me, study of history is twofold. One is by the study of evidence. I'm like a policeman piecing things together. I firmly believe that a good historical researcher is a detective in disguise, because we are trained to look at the evidence, and we're trained one thing, if there is an absolute agreement between various sources, not one iota of difference, the evidence has been doctored. If there are terrible discrepancies, then one of the witnesses or one of the documents is lying. And so this is why I'm saying very often I feel that when I look at historical documents, I'm being a detective, really. It's fun. Because you don't really get involved with life and death questions, sending somebody to jail. So you don't have the responsibility of affecting other human beings in a very drastic and immediate way. But your mind, at least my mind, finds a lot of challenge in piecing things together from evidence. Documents can lie. We all know that when we talk to human beings, people can lie, they can color things, they're motivated by saying this or that because maybe they want to present themselves or the situation in one particular light. We all know that. You know, when you talk to your friends and somebody tells you a story about this or that, a date or a dance, you were going to use a little critical approach. Now, as an historical investigator, I use the same approach to the documents, because documents can lie. And they can be not only inadvertently by making a mistake, but we know several instances of deliberate falsification of documents. So one of the things that, as an anthropologist and ethnohistorian, that as a person who is concerned with the history of groups that don't have written records at all, or written records that don't go very far into the past, I am trained to take with a great deal of salt anything written in books. The second thing that I'm trained to do is to discard the derivative sources. Now, a person who writes a history textbook is really not a historian in the sense that I am, who looks at direct evidence. It is a man or a woman who produce a synthetic product, usually based on the work of somebody else. And it is like a game of telephone. Those derivative histories, especially high school textbooks. The game of telephone I don't have to explain to you. You sit in a circle and you begin whispering a message in somebody's ear, and then you wait until it makes full circle and see if there's any resemblance to the original message. Unfortunately, this is what very often happens, because people uncritically repeat statements that somebody else made without thinking. And very often this happens because the synthesizing historians, they use what's called primary sources, written accounts by people who were on the scene, with written testimony by witnesses. But very often they forget what the policeman knows. To evaluate the witness's testimony, you have to know who that person was, and what was the motivation, and what was the reason for making the record in the first place. A case in point is an account that was published in Russian in 1814, I believe, about the Kodiak Island by a man known as Lieutenant Davidov. Very few people know that Lieutenant Davidov, at the time he hit Kodiak, just turned 17 years of age, that in our terms he would probably have been considered juvenile delinquent, or at least a disturbed teenager, and that he interacted with men who were of different social class, much older than himself, and he was a pest. For example, he and his friend decided to have some fun, So they went out in the town of Sitka and burned some of the houses of the people who lived there. Let me tell you, that didn't sit well among the population of Sitka. They almost created a war between Russia and Japan, but without any authority, because a man who had a great deal to say about Russian-American company, but who too was a very disturbed personality, one Nikolai Rezanov, was upset by the reception the Japanese have given him, and he expressed his wish that somebody would burn the Japanese down. So those two juvenile delinquents who were active here in Alaska sailed their small ship that they called Maybe to Hokkaido and began burning Japanese villages. The only thing that saved them, that Lieutenant Davidov had relatives in high places, so that when they were put in jail by the port commander of a Navy officer in Ochotsk, and they were going to really nail their skins to the wall because it was serious business. Davidov's papa went to various places, pressure was applied, you know, it doesn't happen who you are, it matters whom you know. And so they were sent to the active fleet in the Baltic and put on a warship that went into action to redeem themselves. But if it hadn't been for Lieutenant Davidov's connections in high places, they would have been crucified, figuratively speaking, for their misbehavior. So, but this book by Lieutenant Davidov has been used as sort of sterling source for Alaskan history. And a lot of it is good, because at 17, people's brains are active. He was bright. He was a very bright young man. As you know, some of the brightest young people tend to get into trouble. But he also, he was not a scholar. And so he invented things, and he invented explanations for events that he didn't know anything about. One of the giveaways is, in 1799, a big vessel, the first big English-type vessel, a three-master, built at Seward Peninsula at a Russian port called Voskresensky, or Resurrection Harbor. It's near the modern city of Seward. It was the first, for the times, modern shipyard anywhere on the Pacific coast, including Spanish possessions. They did build ships, but they were no way as the shipyard at Seward. This ship was built by an Englishman who was especially engaged by a Russian-American company to build ships here in Alaska, James Shields. And James Shields also skippered this vessel. This vessel sailed to Ochotsk, very fine sailing times, and it was coming back to Alaska. It was sighted last off Unimak. And incidentally, that article of mine in the Alaska Geographic on the Aleutians, there is a mistake, because I wrote it was sighted off Unimak for the last time, and in the editing somehow it went down off Unimak. It was sighted by the Aleuts in villages in Unimak, and then it disappeared. It disappeared, and wreckage from this ship began to be washed up all along the coast, from Onalaska to way down into southeast. And there is a report by Baranov about what is known. He went wherever the wreckage was found and tried to investigate. There was a big storm in Shelikhov Strait, and it probably went down somewhere in the Shelikhov Strait with all hands. There was not a single survivor. Well, Lieutenant Davidov in 1805-1806 in Alaska heard about the ship, and he says it was commanded by the Englishman, and Lieutenant Davidov admired English Navy very much. Remember, it's a time of Nelson. many of the Russian Navy officers under whom Lieutenant Davidov served as a very young midshipman trained in Britain, served on British ships. Many were at Trafalgar with Nelson and so on and so forth. So he was taught to admire British Navy men. And he says the ship was commanded by an Englishman, so it couldn't have just gone down in the storm. There must be a different reason. He says the crew must have all died of yellow fever. And I don't know how many history books have repeated that the ship went down because the crew was incapacitated because of the outbreak of yellow fever on board. There's just one problem with this story. Anybody? What's the problem? Yellow fever is a tropical disease. Yellow fever couldn't possibly have broken out at the port of Ochotsk, which is about one of the coldest places on Earth. And so on. He has another story which again has been incorporated in many textbooks in Alaskan history. It is the story about the stupid Russian sailors who sailed out of Siberian port, saying a prayer, pushing off into the big ocean and not knowing where they went. You live in Alaska, you know what the sailing conditions are here. People who would sail here with such kind of knowledge are not going to survive. He talks about this ship and he says they sailed, instead of sailing northeast, they sailed south to a very hot climate. The pitch and the planks began to melt, but they made it to Kojak. It always bothered me if the tar began to melt somewhere in tropical waters, how did they get to Kojak? This is what I'm saying. I am a detective. I look at the testimony and say, something is fishy, okay? They made it to Kodiak and they were in a really sad state. And Lieutenant Davidov says they sunk on their knees. I don't remember exact account that all they did to save themselves was pray, but somehow they got to Kodiak. He doesn't explain how. And that Baranov then took pity on them and took them to Unalaska, where they rejoined their company. It was the time before Russian American Company was formed, before there was a monopolistic regime here. Well, we have a document which never made it into history books. We have a document written by an equivalent of an admiral in the Russian Navy who was a Kodiak Aleut, Alexander Filipovich Kashivara. His father came to Alaska at the age of 13, a member of a settler family that went to Yukutat. But he was a bright boy. He looked as if he had some brains up here. Baranov needed able men. He was very short on people. And he says, here is a good prospect. And he apprenticed him to James Shields to be trained in navigation by the latest English methods. We have Filip Kashivarov's own account of this. It somehow never hits the history books. He married here in Alaska. He married a woman of Kodiak. He had 11 children, 9 of them sons. 4 of them became skippers. One of them became a chief of cartography section of Russian Admiralty in the Navy. That was Alexander Kashevar. As a young man, he explored North Shore of Alaska to Barrow and beyond. This is the only voyage that is mentioned in English textbooks. He did many voyages. He was in the Bering Strait area and before 1838 when he went to Barrow. This is the English language account. And this man published in the Navy Journal a letter of protest that Lieutenant Davidov's story about this ship that somehow, with only by the force of prayers, got to the tropics and began to melt apart and then made it to Kodiak, that this is nonsense. And it should not enter history of Alaska. That on the contrary, the skipper was a relatively able man by the name of Yakov Sapozhnikov. Incidentally, he sailed in the Aleutians before this mishap for about 30 years, and you don't survive for 30 years in the Aleutian waters knowing nothing. But he was an old man at the time, and I don't know what happened, but his assistant took over, and they did go, of course, and they ran out of water. And they ran out of food. So when they made Kodiak, indeed, they have been far, of course, the voyage was too long, and they were in a sad state. But the vessel was intact, the men recovered, and Sapozhnikov said, I don't want to navigate it anymore. And Filip Kashevarov, then a young man about 18 years of age, freshly trained by James Shields as navigator, took the ship to Alaska. Far different from melting apart in the tropics. So one of the things that I am trying to tell you is that when you are reading a textbook, behind every statement, there are a lot of material. You are reading a synthetic statement. And when you write a report, a book report, when you are set to write a book report and synthesize the information, very often you miss some essential points. Some points you may misinterpret. So not everything that is in the book is exactly the way it happened. And my feeling is that the history of Alaska is much more interesting than what is in those synthetic histories. Sometimes I get a feeling, you know, I am so interested in little details, what happened day by day, that maybe I'm losing sight of a big picture. I am an analyst, not a synthesizer. But boy, it's so interesting because history is lived at any time by people. People who think, people who hate, people who love, people who have children and are concerned about them, people who want to have meaning in their lives. And when you begin to do the kind of history that I am doing, sort of focusing on a small area and trying to figure out how was it in the time, I begin to know, I know those people. They're friends. Some I wouldn't invite to dinner. I really don't like them. I begin to have a feeling for life in the past. And to me, this is history. History shouldn't be boring. Because history is about life as it was lived at a different times and in a different place. Now for you, the history of the Aleutians is life as it was lived long ago, here. And the more you know it in greater detail, I think the more you get the feeling for it. And you have to know about people. Not about things, not about what remains from the past ages, as you can go and inspect the church. Yes, it is beautiful. But if you go as a tourist and look at it and say, gee, why did they build such a big church, really? And you look at it as a museum, it's dead. To me, the church is the people who build it, the people who used it through the ages, and the people who use it today. It is the community for whom this church is part of their lives. It's part of their ancestors' life, it's part of their life today, and they hope it is going to be part of the life of their children. It's something very much alive. So I like to put faces and names on historical personages. I want to know a group of friends, who were the families that married between each other. And I'm coming up with some surprising answers. It was a whole local society. They were people, families who constantly intermarried, so they kept the leadership to themselves. They were people who were associated with the church for generation to generation. There is a continuity. And when you understand the continuity in a place that is maintained through people from generation to generation, you understand the roots of this community. And that is what history ought to be. Now, having had this lengthy preface and taking up half the time of the class, I think the best thing for us to continue, if you have no objections, Ray, is for you people to ask me questions. If you wanted to get that feeling, what is this place all about from the very beginning, what would you like to know? What would make it to say, this is my home, and this is how my home grew over time? No questions? My goodness, the second graders have had questions. How many of you were born in an Alaska? None? All right. When did you come to an Alaska? Huh? Pardon?
I think it's pretty remarkable what you just said. You said how many are born in Alaska.
Just one? How many of you have lived here 10 years? Oh, well, I discount Ray and Rick. And you were born here, you don't count. How many lived here 10 years? One. Okay. How many lived here a year? Two or three? 2 years. And none of you have been curious, what is this place all about, the place where my parents dragged me to? You don't want to know about the place? That's because your survival doesn't depend on it. This is something else you have to understand, that when we talk as much as 150 years ago, none of you would be considered children. You would be considered responsible adults, able to take care of yourself to survive right here in the Aleutians, to earn your living by your own labor. and not working in the Carl's commercial or waiting tables in the fancy restaurant. My daughter, who came with me here in 75 and 76, wants me to bring photos. I don't have a camera because she doesn't believe me. In Unalaska, no. You would be expected to be able to go out into the sea and get fish and get seals and get birds and provide all the necessities of life for yourself. Now, the Russians who came here, they had the same kind of idea. At 17, you were adult. Philippe Kashivara was apprenticed to James Shields at the age of 13. He commanded his first ship at the age of 15. What it means, they had a different conception of who is an adult and what is expected from adults. Responsible behavior. Nobody said that at 15, Philip Kashivarov shouldn't touch the steering wheel of the two-masted ship that he commanded. He was master of the ship. The Bostonian skippers who came here at 150 years ago to take sea otters and trade with the Russians at Sitka and Kodiak. Well, a man named Sturgis owned two ships by the time he was 19, and he was in command of the ship for 3 years by the time he was 19. It was a different world. Aren't you interested in this world?
Yeah. What type of mount do you find the most accurate? Are you looking like Bancroft, you know, traditional type of history? Are you seeing Vulcan, Russian American company, with, you know, type of wood would be thing, or lead yard, you know, or something like that?
Well,
okay.
Anything that is published, anything that is published, I consider somehow doctorate, because whatever is written for publication is written for an audience. And if not events, the tone is set to comply with the expectations of the audience. Much better are documents, for example, accounts. Because in a commercial establishment, accounts are kept very strictly and they don't lie. For example, we are told that the Russians came, killed off the sea otter, and then they left. Well, this is absolutely untrue. Because, first of all, if you look at the cargoes of the independent companies, if you look how many sea otters they brought in, pair vessel, and then you say, all right, this vessel spent 10 hunting seasons in the Aleutian, so the cargo does not represent a single hunting season. In order to calculate, you have then to average the vessel's cargo, pair hunting seasons they spend a year in the Aleutians. And then you have to calculate how many vessels were hunting in a particular hunting season. And in this way, you arrive at the average of the take. Then you look at who the men were. It wasn't that they discovered the sea otter in Alaskan waters. The sea otters were known in Kamchatka, and they hunted the sea otters in the Kurils and Sakhalin and all those places long before they came to Alaska. They understood the beast. They looked at it as a renewable resource. Therefore, they didn't like, and I'm quoting, to crowd a hunting ground. Expansion through the Aleutian chain by the Russian fur hunters was motivated by this, that we don't want to be crowded. And later on, they began to rotate the hunting grounds. They would let a hunting ground go for a season. And in Russian American company, for example, in Western Aleutians, the outpost of the Russian commercial company, they bought skins at a third tariff from the Aleuts. And they let it be known that for a hunting season, the maximum that the company would buy was 300 skins. So that the Aleuts didn't hunt more than approximately 300 otter skins, 300 sea otters per year. There is an Atkan traditions were recorded in 1952 by a Norwegian linguist Knut Bergsland from Cedar Snigirov. And this book is available, Ray knows it. And he talks about that during the Russian time, only 300 sea otters per year were bought. Therefore, there was no reason to hunt more. When the Americans came, we could take all sea otters that we wanted, and it was good life. We really got rich, and we could trade from the Americans all sorts of material goods. And he says, and then there were no more sea otters. Okay, so this is the way one looks at it. One looks at the reported catches, prorates them per year. In order to understand what is happening to the sea otter, it is not sufficient to look at the Russians' records. Since 1779, 1780, Russians had competitions in Alaska. They had first predominantly British, then predominantly American traders who came and traded with the natives all along Alaska coast, including the Aleutian Islands, which they did secretly so that the Russians wouldn't know about it. For example, one ship, Mercury, in 1786, sailed into the central Aleutians and burned several Aleut villages. That's Mercury. One of the reasons why Captain Billings had his orders to search for the ship Mercury, if it's still in the Aleutian waters, to capture the ship and bring the crew to Ochotsk for investigation and eventual trial and protest to the British government. They had competition. To understand what happened to the sea otter, one has to go to the Bostonian records of cargo and see how many skins each ship that sailed here and then sailed to Canton in China to sell the sea otter pelts, what were their cargoes. Baranov estimated that between 1786 and 1790, they were on an average 6 to 10 British and American ships in what Baranov considered Russian waters, that is Alaskan waters, from Sitka to the Aleutians, and that each ship accounted from 1 to 3,000 pelts. And finally, we have to look at the reports of the United States Coast Guard, which was then Revenue Cutter Service, and particularly the report of Captain Hooper, who was specifically charged with investigation of the condition of the sea otters, when was it, 1898, thank you, I'm awful in remembering dates, being a social anthropologist, as long as I hit the period more or less correctly, I think I'm fine. In 1898, Captain Hooper wrote a report for United States government on the conditions of the sea otter banks. And he says the following. He says, the otter has been depleted since 1867 because all restrictions that the Russians employed on taking the sea otter were removed. One. Secondly, the sea otter howling grounds are exploited continuously while in during the Russian regime, hunting were shifted every 2 or so years. This year, the sea otters are taking here. Next year, they're taking there. They do not hunt the same howling grounds all the time. 3, the Russians took the sea otters by means of the Aleuts, who employed the ancient hunting methods of sea otters, which removed the overhunting. Because what you look then and says, all right, we talk about Aleut hunting methods of sea otters. How many sea otters could one man take? And you find out that the sea otter hunting was done in the summer months, varied with conditions on Atka or in Alaska or at Unimak, from May through June or from June to August, 2 months. That the hunting was done on sunny, calm days, because this is when the sea otters are just enjoying the weather in the sea. In the stormy weather, you won't find sea otters floating in the sea. So you are limited in terms of the season and in terms of the sunny days. Then, how many men? Well, the minimum you needed was 6 double hatch kayaks. That means 12 men for one sea otter, because they used a surround method, which has been described. Do the people know about the method of sea otter surround? Okay. 6 by Darka minimum. But to be successful, they like to employ more. And what was the take for the day? 1 sea otter. 2 sea otters was a cause for celebration. So do you see what I'm driving at? Once you study this, you're saying this is the possible maximum take. We will have to allow for contraband, for illegal taking of sea otters. But this is the 3 points that Captain Hooper made. No restriction on the number of sea otters that could be taken after 1867, no rotation of the hunting grounds, and abandoning the Aleut method of sea otter taking and substituting firearms, which, since the people are greedy, makes for more sea otters killed than are taken, because when the Aleuts use the Aleut spear with detachable point, to this was attached a line, and on the line a bladder float, and the shaft of the spear was being dragged, so it acted like a brake, tired the animal out, but it also prevented the animal, once it was dead, from sinking. So the retrieval rate of the Aleuts was about 100%. With the firearms, you shoot the sea otter, and before you can scoop up the carcass, it goes to the bottom. And if it's in shallow water, it can be retrieved. If it's in deep water, forget it. But you don't want to go home and not have a good catch. So you shoot another sea otter. So that this is the 4th point that Captain Hooper makes. And finally, the Aleuts and the Russians never settled close to the howling ground. This is another element in labor intensity in taking sea otters prior to 1867. Sometimes you had to travel 2-3 days to the hunting ground and back. In 1867, there was a laissez-faire free economics. Here are people hunting sea otters, and here are people who are fishing and making their living from fishing. And the canning process has been invented just about in 1880s, 1890s, and canneries began to be built. And there is a good fishing stream on Saanich, and on the best hunt sea otter howling ground in eastern Aleutians, some private entrepreneur built a cannery. And Hooper says, this polluted the sea. This is a noise. There is noise there. People, sea otters, a Cheyenne. The sea otters went away. So you see, behind the statement that the sea otters were depleted, this is the kind of information that the scholar is going to look for. This is the kind of information you should have, because this is part of your local history. Sea otter was a very important resource for this area since time immemorial. It was provided clothing mostly. Eastern Aleuts, by the way, didn't eat sea otter. Rat Islanders and Atuans did. But in the East, it was cannibalism. They may have eaten it in times of food scarcity, but normally it would be like eating your brother. I'm quoting.
Could you say something about the archaeological work? We have just about 7 minutes. About the archaeological work that's going to be done?
Again, for historians and social anthropologists use the data of archaeology, and archaeology is recovering the material remains from time past, including the garbage dump. We can tell an awful lot about what people throw away. We have organized, after 10 years of negotiations, discussions, we finally organized ourselves and we got some funding for initiating long-term archaeological investigation of an Alaska island. I am more or less the coordinator and the mother of this team. Reconnaissance was done here last year. The archaeological members of this team, Dr. Alan McCartney from University of Arkansas, Dr. Jean Eigner from University of Alaska Fairbanks, Dr. Doug Veltri from Anchorage Community College and his wife Mary were here. Maybe you have met them. I hope you did.
Might work with them.
Yeah. They did some investigation, the reconnaissance. They did some testing of archaeological sites. And this year, I'm happy to say, ARCA company gave us $3,200, which is a shoestring. It is not massive funding, but all of us, including myself, because I'm going to stay over them and say, now, this has social significance. don't dismiss this. This has social significance. And besides, as I say, I am supposed to be mother hen of this enterprise. We're all coming here in July. We are hoping through the Aleut Development Corporation, the summer employment program, and perhaps somehow through the educational program to train some of you and let you participate in our project and exploit you as a local labor force. The more hands we have, the more results we shall achieve. Now what we are going to do, we want to look at some sites in the vicinity of this bay and on the Mackinac Island that may be, by the type of tools that our reconnaissance team found last year, related to the finds in an Angula. Uniqueness of an Angula is undergoing tremendous challenge right now because an Angula type artifacts were found by the Mondan Peninsula. And Doug and Mary Veltri located some here towards Summers Bay and some on Hog Island. And so this is one part of the project to see if an Angula type artifact, it's not coincidental, but it was, there were sites there. So Douglas and Mary Veltri probably will work on that. Jean Eigner, Dr. McCartney, and myself are going to work at Volcano Bay. The reason for this is that we believe from historical records of the war between the Aleuts and the Russians of 1763 and 1765, on which we have very good reports, that at the time, the Aleuts of Unalaska and the Aleuts who occupied the Kunitsin Islands, Akun, Akutan, Kigalda, Avatanet, that they were not allies but enemies, and that they were perhaps even of part of that population was of different origin. There is some artifactual evidence and physical evidence. There are Eskimo and skeletons have been found on Akun. So that they were pushing into an Alaska territory, and by the time the Russians arrived, they had a small string of villages just around the headland from either point to Rees Bay. And Volcano Bay was the big Unalaska outpost to keep an eye on those guys so they don't expand anymore, so to check their expansion. And we propose that if this is true, that if the Kunitsin Islanders at that time still maintained their cultural differences, the excavations that we plan to conduct from either point to Rees Bay will show significant differences in various artifacts, not so much in weapons and tools, because nothing travels from group to group as fast as utilitarian technology, but in style of artistic designs, in decoration of the harpoon heads, in the way perhaps that the houses have been arranged, because for most people of the world, the place they live in is sort of like a model, a microcosm of the world, and it reflects a model of how things ought to be in terms of human relationships. So therefore, if we have two culturally different groups, sometimes there will be a difference in the way they organize their living space. And an archaeologist carefully excavating a site can figure that out. How was the living space used? And we, if indeed there was, at the time of Russian arrival, some kind of difference between those two political units that went beyond politics and local fighting, but if indeed, as Dr. Turner, who excavated an Akun, claims that it was different kind of origin of the population, maybe, then Rees Bay and either point and Volcano Bay that we know was an Alaska stronghold should show some kind of differences. And that's what we're going to do. And we hope that a lot of you will enroll as our slaves. We're going to drive you to dig, sift, brush. We don't dig with spades. We dig with, after we remove the sod, with trowels, millimeters at a time, and then you sift, and then you wash, and then you make a map with quadrants, so that when you uncover a layer at a certain depth, you map exactly what was found in this layer in relation to other artifacts. You draw in each square, here is this, here is that, so that there is a permanent record of what was found where, which we do not have for any archaeological work that has been done in the Aleutian hitherto, at least nothing published. And that is a great drawback, because we can't really independently interpret the evidence.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, great. Good. Thank you. I'll pull this wall and then you can work back into it, okay?
I'm going to go and have a cup of
tea. Oh, yes, I bet. Let me turn this.